Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Well, it's Tuesday, and Donald Trump hasn't been arrested yet, like he said he would be today, right? But it's early yet, so we'll see if the Manhattan grand jury acts to indict or not indict. Remember, that's a possibility, too, after hearing all these witnesses. And whether that comes today, after hearing from what are believed to be the final two witnesses yesterday, we'll see. We only asked one guest one question about this yesterday, and again today, we've decided not to join the media circus by obsessing for 2 hours over speculation when nothing has actually happened. We hope you like that decision. Near the end of the show, we will touch on some of the unique legal issues facing this grand jury right now with Andrew Weissman, who used to be the FBI's general counsel, and he was on the Mueller team. He has an op-ed in the Times today, and if there is Trump indictment news during the morning, we will, of course, cover it as it happens, but we're not going to do what if all morning. And here's one good reason. It's speak to the speaker time. New York City Council Speaker Adrienne Adams is with us. There is so much going on that she matters to right now, largely because City Council and Mayor Adams, no relation, are negotiating the next city budget right now. Yesterday, Comptroller Brad Lander released budget numbers showing the NYPD spent $2.2 billion in overtime last year. He says it was 93% more than budgeted. And they've already exceeded this year's overtime budget, and it's only March. At the same time, the mayor is proposing that funding remain flat for public defenders. And there was a protest yesterday over planned cuts in the mayor's budget to the city's libraries. So on that and more, City Council Speaker Adrienne Adams, whose own district is number 28 in Southeast Queens, joins us now. Madam Speaker, always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks so much, Brian. Thanks for having me back on. It's great to be with you.
And listeners, it's always your chance to speak to the speaker when Adrienne Adams comes on the show. So you're invited to call in at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's dive right in, Speaker Adams, on the budget and the comptroller's report, which the council, I believe her testimony on yesterday, $2.2 billion in NYPD overtime last year, 93% more than you budgeted. Is that okay with you?
No, it's not. And it was actually my first question to the NYPD in the oversight hearing yesterday to try to get to the bottom of it once again. It seems like they're just, you know, bursting through, you know, this overtime spending. And it doesn't look like there's any end in sight. So, again, it's something that the council is very, very concerned about. We asked very pointed questions. The answers we got pretty much pertain to the things that they were doing to remedy the situation for overtime, not what really got them there for the last fiscal year. So we're very concerned, and we're going to have to take a serious look at this.
Can they just decide on the amount of overtime that they spend at will as the year goes on? And can any other agency do that? I'll give credit to New York One. I was watching their Inside City Hall program last night, and somebody raised the hypothetical question, gee, what if the education department decided we're going to let every teacher take as much overtime as they want to stay until 6 or 7 o'clock at night to make sure that every kid gets the individual tutoring to get up to grade level? Can they just do this at the NYPD at will, and could other departments, including the education department, do it?
I saw the same interview you did last night, Brian, and my mouth actually dropped also because it was quite the hypothetical now and quite the what if. We've seen historically NYPD pretty much having carte blanche when it comes to overtime. It has been extremely difficult to, A, get an explanation on it, B, to rein it back in, and C, to really, really get them to have a coherent plan to get this overtime spending in check. I dare say that no other agency could possibly get away with this on the administrative side. NYPD, as we know, is extremely influential. They're very large. They're huge, over 36,000 officers, the largest police department in the entire country. So they do have a special place as far as the administration is concerned. But no, I don't think any other agency would be able to do this.
And you noted yesterday that the NYPD has a low absenteeism rate. And that's a good thing on its face, I presume, but it raises more questions to you about the extent of overtime, right?
Correct. It really does. I can say that, you know, the work of the NYPD is extraordinary. We know that. The protection of our people in this city has to be at top performance. We know that. Absenteeism, I commend them, you know, for the rate of attendance that they have. But again, when it comes to the overtime situation, it is very extreme and it has got to be reined in.
And listeners, let's remember that fact about a low absenteeism rate in the NYPD. Put a bookmark in that, listeners, for when we get to our Rikers Island sequence of this conversation. And I should say, Speaker Adams, at the same time, we're reporting that the police are actually transporting fewer mentally ill, apparently homeless people to hospitals than before Mayor Adams' new policy to increase involuntary hospitalization, right? It was so controversial when he announced it. He said it's in the interest of the people who can't take care of themselves. Other people had backlash. No, this is just the convenience of other New Yorkers who don't want to have to look at them. But it turns out from the stats that we're reporting that there's actually less involuntary hospitalization taking place at the hands of the NYPD. So it further begs the question, what's the NYPD spending all that overtime money on?
Yeah, it really does. And again, this is something that raised our eyebrows in the hearing yesterday as well. You know, what is the overtime being spent on? And again, you know, it still begs the question that we continue to ask, and we are going to continue to ask that. And we will be taking, you know, a hard look at that in our budget.
I guess one way to defend what's going on there would be to say crime is going down in the city. So should there be an attitude of, well, something is working, so let's not pull in the reins too much right now?
I think we could look at both sides. And again, I do commend the NYPD. Crime is definitely going down in the city, which is something that that we all need to celebrate. You know, the perception, again, you know, is that, you know, crime is rampant, and it really is not. It is just the way the crime's being reported and still being reported in the media, unfortunately. But again, you know, to the credit of the NYPD, crime rate in the city is definitely going down. We're happy
and
about that.
And as our WNYC news team reports the numbers, the NYPD's $5.4 billion allotment in the proposed budget from the mayor for the next fiscal year stands in sharp contrast to the flat funding proposed for the city's public defenders, who also testified at your budget hearing yesterday. Would that $5.4 billion be more money for the police next year?
Again, we're going to take a look at that. And but the note that you just made for the DAs and their offices who are in need of, you know, more funding, we're going to have to do that comparison once again and take a look at those numbers to see what we can do to make more equity. That's another word that's used a lot, you know, by myself and by my colleagues. We're going to have to try to take a look at how to make things more equitable across the board.
Well, would it also be accurate to assume that public defenders are more needed than they were a few years ago? Because if the NYPD is making more arrests, if they are making more arrests in the current crackdown, then presumably there are more poor people who need public defenders being arrested, and so that budget should go up proportionally. I mean, that sounds like common sense to me, but do the numbers bear that out?
The numbers say a lot of things, actually, and you're right, partially. I think when we talk about public defenders also, we have to take a look at the numbers that are not there. We need more public defenders. How do we increase that pool, you know, of those individuals that are needed right now to very, very high levels? How do we bring folks in with the talent we've lost, public defenders, to law offices and other places? So we're going to have to take a look at, again, bringing in that workforce that we need. We've got a backlog right now that doesn't seem to want to give us a break also when it comes to the logjam in the court system and getting these cases through. That's another reason why the population at Rikers is high. It's because the courts have not been able to move these individuals that are detained, that have not seen a trial date on Rikers Island, you know, for far too long. So we've got a lot of critical areas to take a look at when it comes to our attorneys, when it comes to our DAs, when it comes to detainees, you know, the whole gamut. The system is just very, very stretched.
And I guess one other aspect of that, according to the public defenders, is that they get paid so little that many of them leave for the private sector when they can get a better paying job. We're going to be doing a related segment later in the show about Advocates for Children in Family Court being paid so little, and it sounds like very similar problem there, but that's for later. Let's take a phone call. Here is Helen in Forest Hills. Helen, you're on WNYC with City Council Speaker Adrian Adams. Hi, Helen.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Speaker Adams. I'd like to know...
Good morning, Helen.
Thank you. I'd like to know your opinion on the mayor's plan for forcing city retirees into the Medicare Advantage plan and how you're planning to vote on it.
Thank you for the question. Another hot topic. You know, we had a very, very extensive hearing on this. I received, you know, personally no less than 10,000 emails. I can't even count the phone calls into my office at City Hall in my district office from retirees that were emphatic about the council not considering legislation or waiting for us. That hearing on the legislation to change the administrative code, and the retiree group expressing wanting the council to hold off on legislation to preserve their legal position in court if the city actually moved forward on Medicare Advantage. And now that's happened. So as a council, we're going to follow the next steps of any legal processes and court decisions. We have to respect collective bargaining. One of the things that, you know, that I felt as speaker is that city council should never have been in the middle of this argument. We are not, you know, we're not the body or a body to get in between collective bargaining for unions. And this was just not an issue for the council, but you know, as the charter state, we had to get involved with this. We right now are not looking at considering legislation. We want the whatever court procedures to go forward. It would definitely be a dangerous precedent for the council, you know, to set in a knee-jerk, you know, reaction to this. The retirees have a representation in labor unions. So it would be short-sighted for us as a council to ignore that. So we're going to allow the parties to collective bargain, you know, and sort this out.
Would it be safe to assume, though, and we get so many calls on this issue, like Helen's, from so many city retirees who don't like the plan to move them into Medicare Advantage, would it be safe to assume that you kind of see both sides of this? Otherwise, you would take a position that, you know, you understand what the retirees object to and why they think it will limit their health care choices. But on the other hand, you see the ballooning costs that the city says it has for retiree health, and it has to do something to keep them covered but not bust the budget. I mean, is that where you are? Or if politically it was more clear to you whose side you wanted to take, you would take it?
you know, again, this was this the whole situation. You know, we took it so seriously and still do. We have to see the whole thing through. But we respected what the retirees were saying to us for months. And they made it very clear. They came in, you know, guns blazing in the hearing. And they knew, I believe they knew that they had the support of the council to do whatever they asked us to do at that time during the hearing, which is what we held back. We, you know, their leadership said, leave us alone. Don't touch this thing. Give us the right to go to court to fight for what we want. And that is the message that the council heard, and that is the message that the council stood on.
So now that a caller raised city retirees, how about current city workers? I gather there's a shortage in some agencies, and it surprised me when I first started seeing this because I think, wow, you know, traditionally, and you know this from probably your mother and other people, your mother, I gather, was a correction officer, it's a path to the middle mm-hmm. class for so many people yeah. who are trying to grab that rung, you know, on the economic ladder in New York City. You would think that there would be a lot of demand to take New York City government jobs, but I read there's a city that there's a shortage of people applying for the positions who are qualified in many departments. To what degree is that the case?
Oh my goodness! You know, this is something that the mayor and I definitely you know agree on. And he and I have talked about this. We've got to do a better job of advertising. The city is you know, historically has been the top employer. And we have got to make it known, you know, to our New Yorkers that there are jobs available. These are great jobs, you know, and there are so many areas that need to be filled right now across the board. For the city of New York, we've just got to do a better job of advertising the fact that we've got jobs available and we need folks to fill them. He and I have agreed that we're going to continue to work together to hold job fairs together and, you know, calls out for folks to come on in and apply for these positions. Some positions, I've spoken about this in my state of the city, which we haven't touched on, but I hope that we touch on that because we've got a lot of good ideas. But I also mentioned some levels that we can, you know, bring down for folks that don't necessarily have college degrees, people with high school diplomas. We need to call them on in for some of these positions. We've got jobs available. So Brian Lara, listeners, please, 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 check the NYC.gov website. Take a look for employment opportunities. We need you to come on in and get to work.
Is Mayor Adams' call for civil servants who have office jobs to work in office 5 days a week discouraging applicants because they have other better hybrid places that they can apply to?
Well, I can't really answer for the applicants. I would imagine, though, that may be the case for some who maybe are used to working, you know, in a hybrid fashion now, because that is that's definitely a popular way to go. But, you know, that and still, I would hope that people would still take a look at various positions across the board. I'm not sure whether or not all of these agencies, you know, in the administration really do. Have a restrictive 5 day a week, or whether there are some hybrid opportunities available. That I don't know. There may very well be.
Right. And the mayor did back off that a bit recently, mm-hmm. His 5 day in person mm-hmm. mandatory. Let me take one more call and then we'll get explicitly to some of the proposals in your State of the City speech. Liz in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with New York City Council Speaker Adrian Adams. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you? As I was telling the person I spoke to, I live in the Bronx. I haven't visited Fordham Road in a while. I don't live in that area, but I went to the library and I drove and I parked my car about 2 to 3 blocks away. And I parked behind a police car that had one of those orange barriers that they just put there. He was on the corner. And I thought it was strange, but I just walked away. 4 hours later, I come back and the police are still there. And it's two young cops. And I felt, and when I looked in their eyes, I saw they were really, really uncomfortable. Maybe, you know, I'm in my 60s and I'm looking at them. They knew I wasn't from the area, I guess. But what they did just before I came up, they just got on their bullhorn from the car and yelled at these guys to just, you know, they were just standing and talking and laughing, and they made them walk or break up. But my point is, you're talking about how much money has been spent on the police. Why is there a unit that just sits on one corner and just watches that four corners? They're not going around the neighborhood, walking, seeing what's happening, you know, policing, making sure everything's nice and comfortable. And Fordham Road was just a few blocks away. They're not walking up and down that busy commercial area. So I just felt really uncomfortable for the police, uncomfortable for the neighborhood. It was just a situation that could blow up. Because the police officer, and it was cold that night, and these poor police officers are standing there for hours. So why is that their units there? And I've been born and raised in New York. I've lived in Brooklyn. I've lived everywhere. I've visited everywhere, and I've never seen this before. So what is Adams doing by placing police officers on one corner?
Yeah, and I don't know if the speaker can answer so specifically that particular posting, but I guess you could also generalize from this that, you know, other people may be seeing similar things and thinking, what are they doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I think you have the wrong Adams on the show this morning too. You know, to adequately address, you know, the staffing of the NYPD, I'd be puzzled also, you know, to know why a unit or, you know, a car or cars would be staged, you know, just sitting in a particular area. I can't even deign to guess, you know, why. Each borough has their own issues, you know. All of our boroughs have specific issues. I don't know if that may have been a troubled section, quote unquote, where the NYPD would be staged there, you know, to, you know, watch out for the areas. There may have been a history of trouble there. So I don't even want to guess, but it sure is a good question. And, you know, again, I don't think I'm the right Adams to answer that one.
Well, as a follow-up to that on police funding, you have a big rift in city council right now. 15 of the 35 members of the Progressive Caucus quit the group, as you know, over the caucus's latest mission statement, which calls for reducing the, quote, size and scope of the NYPD. As Speaker, you are on every caucus, but I see you did not sign that new mission statement pledge yourself. Do you support or not support reducing the size and scope of the NYPD?
You know, and speaking of the caucuses, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm ex officio on every single caucus of the New York City Council, from the Jewish caucus to the Black, Latino, and Asian caucus to our LGBTQ plus caucus, and every caucus into the Italian caucus, all of them. So for me to choose a pledge on one caucus to be actively involved would just, you know, it would set a precedent for all of the other caucuses that, again, as Speaker, I'm an ex officio member, but I don't involve myself in their inner deliberations, not any of the caucuses.
But do
the council is united behind...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say the council is united behind the major budget priority that our city agencies have the capacity and staff that ensure essential services are delivered to New Yorkers, you know, and, you know, some things are missing from the mayor's preliminary budget. You know, when we take a look at the budget right now being underway, pulling back funds, putting in more funds, our focus is to ensure that we prioritize investments in essential services that keep people healthy and safe. So I'm going to support further investments in many of the safety solutions we fought for in last year's budget, like trauma recovery centers and crime victim services. We spoke about it a lot, youth employment programs and a lot more, but this budget needs to prioritize investments and services like that that help New Yorkers and, you know, making sure our agencies are functioning to deliver those services.
So that sounds like you agree with the premise of the Progressive Caucus statement, which is that budgets are finite, so your priority should be community investments, like in housing and mental health, which I know are in your State of the City, and education, more than they are to stop the cycle of marginalization, which leads to crime, which leads to the need for more police, which leads to more mass incarceration. You'd agree with that premise?
I would agree with that, Brian. Yep.
All right. State of the City. You get a speech called State of the City, just like the mayor gets one of those. And you reemphasized, among other things, the plan that is already law to close the Rikers Island jail complex by 2027. The mayor has been casting doubt on that because with crime higher the last few years, there are more arrests and there won't be enough cells in the borough jails to close Rikers on time, he argues. Do you argue that Rikers can still be closed?
I do. You know, Rikers is undermining safety in our city, and it's a place that no longer serves our city. I've mentioned many, many times, and you just did, my mom, who was a correction officer on Rikers, and, you know, it was clear. You know, she believed that Rikers should have closed a long time ago. So the city has to close Rikers by 2027, and the contracts have to align that meet that deadline. And we do expect the administration to work constructively with all of the stakeholders in taking active steps to ensure compliance with the law. But there are steps that we have to take to help ensure closure that are also critical to improve public safety in our city. So we know that the growth in population is being driven by, you know, detainee stays on Rikers, which I mentioned a little while ago. It's a lot longer. So we need to address the court delays that keep the detainees in jail longer than necessary before their trial. Over half of people detained have a mental health diagnosis, which you mentioned, you know, at the top of the show. So we have to ensure that people are getting appropriate treatment by working with the state to expand mental health courts and treatment diversion programs that keep people out of the jail by getting the right intervention to help them. We have to have investments in reentry programming that transition people into jobs and supportive housing. We need to talk more about supportive housing. Other opportunities that provide stability are also critical to reduce recidivism. So, yeah, we've got some work to do. I do absolutely believe it's possible.
And we talked earlier about NYPD absenteeism rates being low. I said to remember that stat, folks, right? They do show up at work, in other words, but one of the problems people cite on Rikers is rampant correction officer absenteeism, which their contract apparently allows. And critics argue that allows more violence and more neglect of incarcerated people's basic needs to occur there. Do you agree absenteeism abuse is an issue there? And can the city council do something about that by passing a law?
You know, that's a great question. I absolutely, well, you know, they've admitted, you know, in oversight, they've admitted that absenteeism has been an issue for a number of years. And because of the way that, you know, the way that they deal with absenteeism, a lot of it is allowed, and it's gotten to critical proportions. I believe the new commissioner says that they are getting better at it, but that was one of the requests that the council denied as far as their budget request last year was to increase headcount. Well, our stance was your absenteeism. You know, there's your headcount right there. Make your people come to work. So we've done our due diligence as far as disallowing additional headcount for correction officers. We would prefer for their own internal oversight and management to get it together as far as, you know, bringing the officers back to work who have been in an abusive pattern in remaining absent for far too long.
Another focus of your State of the City speech was housing, obviously a perennial top priority in New York City. The mayor and governor seem to have a unified housing plan that's being debated in Albany right now. Mayor Adams appeared at a WNYC event on housing at the Green Space yesterday, and here's something he said about how he defines affordable housing.
Affordable to me is market, middle, low income, because I need my middle income and my market individuals in the city as well.
Would you define affordable housing the same way as that or differently? And what have you got coming from city council on that?
You know, for the most part, I would tend to agree. I take a look at the way that we've been doing affordable housing, quote unquote, in the council last year is nothing short of phenomenal. We have opened doors that have been closed for a long time. And last year, the council approved over 40 land use projects to create more than 12,000 units of housing, with more than 60% being affordable. And affordable, again, I would tend to agree with the mayor, those that traditionally have not been able to live here in New York because of the cost of living. But we know that our efforts have to expand to meet the scale of the challenge. So in December, I rolled out my housing agenda, which focuses on increased housing production under a fair housing framework. It's also focused on deeper affordability and preservation of existing housing and restoring the capacity and resources of our housing agencies. So, yes, we are looking at a bill. Through my fair housing framework legislation, I'm seeking to ensure that an equitable distribution of affordable housing production across this city be for the people, because every district has to contribute to solving the housing crisis. We can no longer sit by and say, you know, let that borough, that district handle affordable housing. The crisis belongs to New York, and New Yorkers have to solve it. So we're going to be introducing legislation pertaining to my fair housing framework in the coming weeks.
I know you got to go in a minute. Open mic to end. Anything else from your State of the City speech or anything else you want to draw attention to that I didn't ask about or a caller didn't ask about?
Well, thank you. Thanks again for having me. It's always great to be with you. My State of the City this year, we spoke about people over everything. And we chose that theme because my agenda is focused on meeting the needs of everyday New Yorkers, our workers, our families, our children. You know, the essentials that the people of our city need include access to economic mobility, affordable housing, which we just spoke about, and healthy and safe neighborhoods. So for our city to succeed, we have to ensure equitable investments for all communities with a focus on those historically underserved in our city.
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting, as it is every year, to see how the city council and mayor negotiate a next city budget. Budgets aren't just about numbers, as many of our listeners realize. They really are about policy and resources and the direction and future of the city every single year. The budget year begins July 1st, so between now and then, these negotiations are going to get real. New York City Council Speaker Adrian Adams, we always appreciate when you come on. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We've been celebrating Women's History Month here on The Brian Lehrer Show by highlighting women working in what are traditionally seen as male professions. Last week, we covered women in what we call the trades, and before that, we heard from women working in tech. Today, we will add to this with discussion centering women in the field of constitutional law. Of course, the Constitution was written by a group of men. We often refer to them as the Founding Fathers, right? And they had a specific vision of the type of person who would even be considered a citizen of this country or had the right to vote. Eventually, women got the right to vote. And 100 years ago, just after women got the right to vote, a group of women drafted and introduced the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, today the ERA remains unratified, of course, although lawmakers are currently drumming up support for the amendment as women and members of the LGBTQ community face growing discrimination and threats to their rights. With us now on kind of two tracks in this last segment of the show today to talk about the state of the ERA 100 years after its initial introduction, and also to talk about judges and lawyers who interpret the Constitution and also happen to be women, is Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Elizabeth, hi. Welcome back to WNYC. Good to have you again.
Thank you so much. Always good to talk to you.
And listeners, We want your voice if you are a woman working in constitutional law, or because that might be a needle in a haystack, any other form of law for that matter. Why did you decide to become a lawyer, and what is it like to become to be a woman practicing law in 2023? Do you feel that there are still glass ceilings, barriers to be taken seriously? And do you read the Constitution if you are in constitutional law per se, if you're a lawyer or a judge or a retired woman judge, maybe having time at this time of day to listen? Do you think you read the Constitution differently at all based on gender? 212-433-WNYC. Women lawyers, 212-433-9692. So, Elizabeth, the Constitution was written entirely by men, as I mentioned in the intro. Do you see that influencing the language of the document at all, beyond the fact that women were not included as voters?
I mean, absolutely. You know, if you think about the way in which women might have written the Constitution differently, you know, obviously thinking about who is included in democracy, who gets to serve on juries, who gets to vote and be voted for. And also, I just want to make sure that we're not defaulting to white women, because certainly if we had the voices of Black women, Indigenous women included in the drafting of the Constitution, you know, a lot of the original sins of our Constitution related to the institution of slavery or the treatment of Native Americans, I think would not have been included in that language. And we also probably would have had protections against equality and liberty limiting state laws included from the beginning, instead of having to wait until after the Civil War to have those things amended into the Constitution. And really that second founding after the Civil War is where we really start to see equality, liberty, equal citizenship in the words of the Constitution. You know, they aren't the ideals of the Declaration didn't really get written into the Constitution until after the Civil War and after generations of activists and abolitionists amended the Constitution to make it more in line with those inclusive, equitable ideals of the Declaration of Independence.
Are women mentioned at all in the Constitution explicitly?
So, you know, that's an interesting question. The word male doesn't appear in the Constitution until the 14th Amendment. And even when we talk about the 19th Amendment, which obviously expanded the right to vote to women, it talks about how the right to vote shall not be discriminated against on the basis of sex. And also the Equal Rights Amendment also does not specifically mention the rights of women. It speaks to the it says that equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged on account of sex. But I think that one thing about the language of the Constitution, and I thought you asked a really great question in your request to the listeners to call in, does being a woman make you read the Constitution differently? And obviously, I think, you know, the law is the law. But one thing that I will say about that is that those of us who were excluded from many of the promises of the founding, whether it's people of color, women of all colors, you know, we are keenly aware of the Constitution as an amended document and an amendable document, mm-hmm. because we had to write ourselves into the story of our nation's legal charter. We had to ensure that we staked our claim as we the people in a way that I think others are not always so aware that we have this arc of constitutional progress because of the amendments to the Constitution, because of these generations of activists who said, we are part of we the people, and we are going to write ourselves into the United States Constitution, and in the process, push our country further along this arc of progress.
Let's take a phone call. And I think we have Judith in Fairfield County with a little Women's History Month history from her family that relates to women in the law. Judith, you're on WNYC. Oh, we don't have her line. There we go. Judith, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. Big fan of yours. Yeah, just a quick thing on my mom, who I really admire. She was a single mom of five. a college professor, and at 40 decided to go to law school, one of the first women at Willamette Law School in Oregon. Then she moved to, we moved to Wyoming, and the first thing she did was interview with a very famous Wyoming defense lawyer. And after interviewing with him, he said, "Nice bust." And his partner apologized, and my mom quickly came back and said something like, "I found that men that, you know, talk big don't perform well," but that was shocking. And then my last story was, as soon as the Supreme Court ruled that lawyers could advertise, mom was the first in her county in Wyoming to advertise. She wanted to let people know there was a new lawyer in town, a woman lawyer in town, and she received so much flack from men lawyers saying, "That makes us just like car mechanics or something." But she prevailed, and the local newspaper just ran the story like the 40 years later thing. So,
wow.
That's my story. Proud of my mom.
Did she ever reflect to you on progress over the years?
You know, she did. And she really admired people like, was it Sandra Day O'Connor?
Was the first
she really
Supreme Court Justice.
relished watching women succeed.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you very much for that. Personal as well as national history. Rachel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, I'm a huge fan of the show. So I am a public defender in Manhattan. So definitely constitutionally adjacent. I would call myself a constitutional lawyer. My job is in the Constitution. So I love my job, but it definitely comes with challenges, especially being a youngish woman in this profession. I feel as though we have to go the extra mile to be taken seriously by clients and judges alike, which is kind of a tale as old as time. But as for the Constitution itself, it's interesting. I think of it as a shield through which I protect my clients. That's the whole point. But also, it's so deeply flawed. One of your earlier callers said, or something that I was very much thinking, that the Constitution wasn't created with me or my clients in mind. My clients are largely Black and Brown indigent individuals in Manhattan, and the Constitution was not created with them in mind. So I want to use it to help them and protect them against the behemoth of the government and the laws, many of which are quite draconian against my clients, but I need it to change because it's not doing a good enough job protecting them.
Rachel, thank you very much. Elizabeth, you want to comment on either of those callers and maybe even tell a little bit of your own story, why you became a woman in constitutional law?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the first caller's mention about Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman Supreme Court justice, is I remember when I was in high school learning about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the second woman on the Supreme Court, and shout out to my American history teacher in high school, Mrs. Mulheron, who really, you know, did a great job, I think, of teaching us the ways in which women advocates, which Justice Ginsburg was a lawyer making these arguments to the Supreme Court about equality before she became a justice on the bench, writing the opinions, enforcing equality. And that definitely was something that was inspiring to me. You know, I've always been inspired by the promises of the Constitution and been challenged to try to make them more real for all of us in this country in my daily work. And I feel extremely blessed to be a constitutional lawyer. I love my work, I love my colleagues, and I love the progress that I've been able to witness just in my career as a Supreme Court lawyer who specializes in constitutional law. You know, when I used to meet people for the first time, you know, there was a special section of the Supreme Court that is for members of the Supreme Court bar. And it was actually pretty easy. I would sort of joke, but it wasn't really a joke. You know, I'm the lady, you know, because there wouldn't be that many of us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then I'd be, I'm the blonde lady, because there were just, you know, then there were a few more. And now we have women who are represented on the bench. Right now we have four women on the Supreme Court. We have had six women Supreme Court justices in total. We have stellar Supreme Court advocates, including our nation's Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar, who just gives tour de force arguments time after time in the Supreme Court. And that definitely has been a change since I, even just in, you know, my, you know, 2 decades being a Supreme Court lawyer. And that is really great to see. And I hope that it really inspires the young women out there today, you know, seeing Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson brilliantly talk about the Constitution and legal statutes, you know, to be inspired by that and to be inspired to see themselves in the constitutional story and know that it's a dynamic one that they themselves can shape.
And so to the Equal Rights Amendment, which this is the 100th anniversary of, I believe it was introduced in every session of Congress from 1923 to 1972. Here's a clip from the 1970s, early 70s, I believe, of Gloria Steinem on the Equal Rights Amendment from a newsreel of that era.
After 2 centuries of a constitution written by, for, and about white males, with people of color and women in various conditions of servitude and childlike status and inequality, the majority of women and men, and white men too, are finally rising up and saying, women of all races are citizens.
So, Elizabeth, in our last 30 seconds, with all the anti-discrimination laws that are in place now, what additionally would the ERA provide?
Well, I think, you know, as we've seen with the overturning of Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court, gender equality is very much at risk, whether it's reproductive justice issues, pay gap, violence against women, sexual harassment. There are a lot of issues where we still have so far to go. And while I think the existing Constitution and great laws like the Civil Rights Act could be used to protect those rights, the fact is that they're not to a degree that is untenable. And so the ERA, I think, would make a strong statement that women and people of all genders are equal, they have equal citizenship status, and they are deserving of equal dignity, rights, and liberty. And that's important. That's important for our country. It's important for the individuals who, you know, are threatened every day by violence, by inequality.
Elizabeth Weidra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, for having this great discussion.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We begin today with retirees in revolt, not just in France, as many of you were just hearing on the BBC, but in New York and across the United States. Maybe they should be chanting, "We're old, we're bold, get used to it." The issue in France, as you've been hearing, is raising the official retirement age from 62 to 64. The issue here is forcing retirees off traditional Medicare and into the managed care plans known as Medicare Advantage. It's happening to seniors all across the country. Here in New York, the issue is really coming to a head right now for retired New York City public sector workers, teachers, firefighters, and many others. Just yesterday, Mayor Eric Adams refused those retirees' request to have the option as individuals to stay on traditional Medicare. He said the city can't afford it. Also yesterday, some of you may have seen the New York Times had a story about the Biden administration trying to reduce payments to Medicare Advantage plans because it says those private plans are costing the government more than traditional Medicare, not less, because they've been found to overbill the government in organized acts of fraud. And here is maybe the most bizarre and troubling aspect of this trend, at least locally. The mayor and the New York City public sector union leaders are on the same side. That's right, union leaders like Michael Mulgrew, president of the UFT, very much in the crosshairs here, are imposing this unwanted shift in healthcare plans to their own retired members, apparently in exchange for higher pay for the current workers. In fairness, the switch will also provide some new benefits, such as routine hearing and vision exams, hearing aids, and mental health care provided via telemedicine. that traditional Medicare doesn't have. Many older Americans are choosing Medicare Advantage plans voluntarily. Here's Mulgrew, leader of the teachers union, in a WNYC interview on March 10th, saying retirees will mostly get to keep their current doctors.
Our goal was to make sure that we actually matched all the benefits that our retirees currently have and then see what we could actually gain in negotiations by really being hard-nosed about it with the company.
But after those negotiations, many retired teachers and other city workers are not convinced. They're angry, they're scared about their health futures, and they feel betrayed by their own unions. They're old, they're bold, get used to it, and they're calling in already like crazy. So let me give out the phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And joining us now with those unhappy retirees' perspective is Mary Ann Pizzitola, president of a group that has formed around this issue, the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. She herself is retired from the FDNY's EMT branch. Mary Ann, thanks for your service, first of all, and thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Just to help our listeners get to know you a little more, what more specifically did you do as a city worker, and when did you retire?
I worked for New York City EMS in 1996. The EMS branch was merged into the New York City Fire Department. I was an EMT for New York City, and I retired in 2004.
There are hundreds of thousands of New York City workers in any given year. So can you give us a rough number of how many current New York City retirees there would be today?
The city uses the number 250,000 Medicare-eligible retirees, and that would be your over 65 or your disabled retirees. There are many more that are under 65.
And they would all be switched into this one Aetna Medicare Advantage plan involuntarily?
Yes, stripping them of their current 14 choices of health care plans and forced into one managed Medicare Advantage plan.
So maybe the answer is obvious, but what led you to start this group, the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees?
Specifically to challenge this issue, as we know what we were promised when we were hired, that we would have a choice of health care plans, and because we gave up years of higher wages in order to maintain or preserve our health benefits, that we would have these benefits until our death. We were told that the benefits that we had in employment would carry over into our retirement, and this was something that we relied upon as a form of deferred compensation. So to have that reliance on being in a federal public benefit of Medicare, a gift given to us by President Lyndon Johnson and Mayor Lindsay, to then have it taken from us by this administration and our own unions, is absolutely a disgrace. So we decided we were going to fight back. Our concern was that we are very familiar, or as customized as Mr. Mulgrew likes to say this plan is, it's not traditional Medicare. And this is where it gets concerning, and why we decided to push back, was because you are stripping people out of a current benefit that they have, and all the little perks that you want to say makes it custom, like a silver sneaker or a hearing test, which you can still get, is not enough. Where we're giving up access to our medical providers, narrowed networks that prevent us from seeing all of the doctors in America that accept Medicare today, and then being subject to prior authorizations, where instead of my doctor determining what my care should be, I'm leaving it to a health insurance company.
Let me get you to talk more about the dispute that the retirees have with your unions. This may be the most surprising part to people who are not already involved in this issue. As I understand it, the roots of this go back to a labor agreement struck with the de Blasio administration nearly a decade ago to give raises to city workers in exchange for promised savings on healthcare costs, which keep going up. And this is a big way the union is making good on their part of the agreement, Medicare Advantage for retirees. I've read that this is projected to save the taxpayers $600 million a year. Is that your understanding of why we're even having this conversation?
This would be the first time, Brian, that a union in history negotiated a contract that was partially funded on the backs of other union workers and retirees. That contract was basically the start of the destruction of the labor movement in New York City. That absolutely happened. In 2014, the UFT negotiated a contract that was partially funded by other labor organizations and the retirees. It required $1 billion to be transferred to the city from the Health Insurance Stabilization Fund that primarily benefits active workers and under 65, non-Medicare retirees, provides the differences in premium for their healthcare plans as well as their prescription, vision, and dental, their welfare fund benefits. Out of that Health Insurance Stabilization Fund, a Medicare retiree does not typically benefit other than a welfare fund benefit, their prescription, vision, or dental. And managers who are not union are also affected by this change. They don't have a union, but then they are also compelled to the same decisions that the Municipal Labor Committee make. So, yes, that is exactly how that happened, that they negotiated a savings that was borne by the rest of us in order to get their collective bargaining raises. So they sold off, how we say, they sold off their most vulnerable population, their Medicare-eligible retirees, in order to benefit themselves with collective bargaining. And that is that's very sad.
So you feel like your interest as union retirees is being pitted against the interest of your fellow union members who are younger and still in the workforce.
Yes, and they don't even see it coming because this is our right now, but this is their future. And to try to get them mobilized that this is exactly what's happening, that their unions within the MLC, and it's not all the unions, the Municipal Labor Committee itself is an organization that's completely outdated and not democratic. They have 102 unions, but it's a weighted voting structure. So one vote for every 250 members is the voting structure. They can pass a motion with a two-thirds vote, which they can primarily do with just the teachers union, the UFT, and DC-37, even if the other unions don't agree. And in this last vote that they had, 13 unions voted yes, 17 unions voted no, 10 unions abstained, and another 13 were no-shows. When you add the District Council 37 locals, because they also have a weighted vote in this. However, DC-37 would, as a whole, you would use whatever the majority was. 32 DC-37 locals voted yes, 9 DC-37 locals voted no. So when they say that this was an overwhelming majority, that's disingenuous. Because the UFT and DC-37 hold the largest amount of numbers of memberships, that is why they say overwhelmingly, because Michael Mulger can come up with several thousand, you know, numbers. It's just not right.
We'll play another clip in a few minutes of Michael Mulgrew when he was interviewed on the station a couple of weeks ago, saying why he thinks this is going to be okay for the retirees. So that's coming up. And before we start taking some of the many phone calls that are coming in on this, just to finish this one thought on the relationship between you all as city unionized city retirees and your union leaders. Do the union leaders have incentive to not represent retirees as well as current workers because the current workers get more of a vote on contracts, or they pay more in dues, or what would give the union leaders incentive to disadvantage you over current workers?
Value. Retirees under New York State Taylor Law cannot be represented by their former unions. Taylor Law allows the unions to represent those in their collective bargaining unit for wages, hours, and work conditions. I, as a retiree, do not have that. This is why I find this so disturbing that the city council will say that they still need clarity and that we should go and collectively bargain this. We do not collectively bargain. We're retired. We made our deals, and this is up to the city to respect those decisions and not allow or engage in with our former unions to negotiate us away for value for them. That is purely putting labor against the retirees, and OLR themselves did it. I can understand, look, you know, everyone has a financial hardship. You have inflation at like nearing 9% at some points, and everything is expensive these days. But retirees are on small pensions, fixed pensions. Our pensions only raise by 1% to 3% of the CPI. Can you live on a raise of $540? It's 1% to 3% of the CPI in the first $18,000 of your pension. This year was the first year, I can't tell you, since I don't even ever remember getting a 3% increase in a pension. So $540 doesn't really get you that far. They are definitely selling off retirees' value. Michael Mulgrew said it in a video that's on my YouTube channel. He said, the city said to us, if you can give us back that 20% plan, meaning our supplement to our Medicare, we'll give you that $600 million we would have spent on them and put it in your welfare funds. Tell me that's not a quid pro quo that they just sold us off like cattle to fund the active unions. I mean, we should be able to provide union raises to labor because they earned it and they deserve it and they're underpaid to begin with. But it shouldn't be about pitting your former retired labor against labor in order to fund those things. That's a disgrace.
So structurally, if I hear you correctly, you as a retired EMT are no longer represented by your union. All the retired teachers are no longer really represented by the UFT, even though you're at their mercy to negotiate your health benefits.
Yes, and this is why we relied upon a few things: legislation, litigation, and the city council. Because if my union is no longer, the unions don't represent us, and that's a fact, and that is law. But they always looked out for a retiree because they knew they would one day be one. Victor Gottham, Lillian Roberts all said, never touch a retiree health benefit. And yet this is exactly what's happening. Once you open this door, this is going to keep on happening. What else are you going to take from me? So yes, you're absolutely correct. Retirees, I don't vote for their contracts. I don't vote for their union presidents. There's only one union that I'm aware of in the city that allows retirees to vote. In a partially weighted vote structure is the United Federation of Teachers. But they tie that union dues to healthcare benefits to keep them within the organization. So, but the short answer is no. A union does not represent the interests of a retiree. They don't even let us in the MLC meeting. And this is why we relied upon the council.
I see, in fact, that some of the people calling in are current workers as well as retirees. So we're going to see if there's a coalition forming there or if they feel like their interests are being pitted against your interests fairly. We're going to take a break here and then continue. Listeners, as some of you might be fretting over, Marianne Pizzitola's line is not so great, and we're going to reconnect, and I'm confident we're going to get her on a better line, and then we're going to go to some of your phone calls, another clip of Michael Mulgrew, as this conversation continues. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the New York City plan to switch New York City public employee retirees from traditional Medicare into a Medicare Advantage managed care plan against their will to save money as part of a deal with the representing unions, with Marianne Pizzitola, president of a group that has formed around this issue, the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees, and Sarah in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Sarah, thank you for calling in.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. I'm from the Cross Union Retirees Organizing Committee. We've been on the street for 2 years fighting this nonsense. Now, just a few days ago, we had a hearing, a public hearing, on the OL, the Office of Labor, the OLC was having about the Aetna contract. Now, the Aetna contract that was put on the public hearings page and that everybody referred to the day of presenting their testimonies on this Aetna contract, now they're saying that that contract was erroneous. The contract that had three different options, option A, B, and C, on the attachment B of that Aetna contract. Now, that option C gave us the right through the Aetna contract to keep what we have. The city would have to pay an extra $20 a month for people But that was an option that Aetna agreed to in their contract. Now,
but that's, is that exactly what the mayor rejected yesterday?
Yes, he rejected it. He said option C is not an option. However, now they are saying that a letter that they sent out dated March 10th, which nobody has received yet, at least many of us have not received yet, is the real contract, not the contract that was posted on the OLR website that everybody referred to in that public hearing. If that contract was a mistake, then those hearings are invalid. And we want to find out why our union leaders, mine is Michael Mulgrew, he's one of the ringleaders in this. He forgot that he was elected to protect our benefits. And he's in cahoots with the city to only offer us a privatized Medicare disadvantage plan. Other proposals have been put
forth by the
TSC.
Medicare disadvantage. Sarah, let me jump in and ask you a follow-up.
Yeah.
Right. It's a private managed care plan that has a relationship with Medicare. And there are many retirees around the country having similar battles. Also, many going into Medicare Advantage plans voluntarily, and we'll get to that. But Sarah, let me ask you one follow-up question, just relating to the part of the conversation that I was having with Mary Ann before the break. If you feel so betrayed by Michael Mulgrew and feel that he, as a union leader, is more in cahoots with management, the city in this case, than representing you, why do you think he would sell out retired members?
Well, I think he got into trouble years ago when he decided to remove $1 billion out of the health stabilization fund that was earmarked for health benefits, and he used it to pay back pay to current teachers. Now, the rest of the MLC went along with it because he, Henry Garrido, and Harry Nespoli, as Mary Ann said, the MLC has a weighted vote.
Michael Mulgrew
and the other two basically decide everything. So they went along with that. Now, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money. So they decided they're going to give the city $600 million a year forever to pay them back and
right.
cut costs. The point
and
is,
that's interesting
the PSC
to say.
Professional. Yeah, go ahead.
Marianne, go ahead.
She's making a good point in that. In the 2021 agreement, when the 2018 agreement ended, the city of New York sent a letter to the mayor, de Blasio, saying that the 18 agreement, the MLC agreement, was completed successfully and that they met all their savings benchmarks. And they were going to implement Medicare Advantage not to to meet a savings benchmark, but solely to fund the stabilization fund, which we have been shown that has been misused by the city of New York and the MLC, was used for things other than it was intended to, and it doesn't serve a Medicare-eligible retiree other than those in unions and for welfare fund benefits only. The true benefit to that fund is for active workers and some of the under 65 retirees. So
right.
why
I
would you sell off a...
Yeah, and I think we have an active worker on the phone next, and Sarah, thank you for your call. Jen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how are you? I'm the chapter chair at Hunter College, and so I work with a bunch of active workers and also people who are on the cusp of retirement. My union, the PSC CUNY, has been among the unions within the MLC who's been leading the effort against privatizing healthcare and against what's been happening. And I guess what I want to say is two things. One, this is a real violation, right, of this promise to workers. I see people just as what's been said, right, really afraid, like we're on the cusp of retirement and really afraid of what's been coming, because we know there's not private business magic that, like, saves money other than, like, denying and prolonging care to people that's really harmful, right? And study after study across the country on Medicare Advantage or disadvantage shows that. But I want to say something else. And I hope, you know, there are tons of active workers who are listening to this show right now who have things like GHI and premium-free healthcare. And part of what we know about the sort of analysis on how to save $600 million is we view this, right, as the sort of opening shot to come after premium-free healthcare for everybody. Because once this happens, then the sort of door has been kicked open to sort of say, okay, well, you, even though you work and make less money than you would in the private sector, like I make less money right now, right, working at Hunter College than I did at, than I did at a nonprofit organization, right? Even though you make less money and you have premium-free healthcare as part of this bargain, your family is now, in fact, going to, like, pay a benefit. Like, we're now going to charge you, right? And so we've been making a deal, right? We've been making a deal for this, right, as city workers, and now we see that being eroded. And so I hope everybody, and it's been frustrating how many active workers have not been following this issue, and it's complicated. And so part of the reason why I wanted to call in is not only to stand up for retirees, but also to get every active worker and all New Yorkers to pay attention to this issue because it really matters.
Right. So, Jen, let me ask you. I know that Marianne's group has been trying to rally active workers to kind of take their side and form a coalition. I mean, I am reminded of what's going on in France where they're trying to raise the retirement age. It's not the retirees primarily who are out in the streets. It's the active workers because they know it's going to affect this, them when they reach 62 or 64 years old in that case. Obviously, this is going to affect all the active workers when they become retirees too. So do you... Are you doing this, Jen? Are you finding apathy or are you finding interest among the current workers as yourself a current worker chapter chair as you spread the word on this issue?
I certainly see interest within like my union, within the PSC CUNY of workers within CUNY, because our union has done a really good job educating members about this issue because it's really complicated and it's hard to sort of follow. And I guess the shout out that I would say is I really hope that UFT teachers, active teachers, are the group that is really paying attention to this right now because they are one of the groups, and DC 37 workers, actives, they are the group because of the how the MLC works, they are the workers that could really change this in the future. And I really hope they are the people that are paying attention and they're the people with whom we need to create solidarity. I talk to DC 37 workers who work within CUNY all the time about this issue, and that's the movement we need to build. And honestly, we're really scared and there's a lot of work to do.
Jen, thank you very much. So there's your rallying cry, Marianne. I think if I heard Jen correctly, it's that they should see this as an opening shot to privatize or add premiums to active worker health benefits, not just retiree benefits. That comes first. The rest of it may come later if this goes through. That's a powerful argument.
Well, it is. And, you know, we're in this situation, unfortunately, because the de Blasio administration refused to negotiate contracts with the unions, leaving them desperate to, unfortunately, make a deal like this. But when you're looking at Medicare Advantage, you have the New York Times, Kaiser Health leading the way with putting out information, facts, citing, sourcing information. Even Congress is holding hearings exactly on this. So when you start to look at the problems about this, because this is a national debate about this company. If I were to say to you, hey, you're using a vendor that's been accused of fraud, would you use that vendor? No. But see, this is the exact situation. Every Medicare Advantage company is either indicted or under investigation by the Department of Justice, under investigation by the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General, and yet we are moving in line with this company and forcing retirees into this one plan who we've been trying to get the mayor to listen to us and say, listen, I have members right now that live in continued care communities, assisted living, nursing care, that this plan's not going to cover. And these are our most vulnerable. Why are you forcing us into this?
And it's not just Aetna. You mentioned the New York Times coverage. Here's an article that they just had yesterday. Headline, Biden plan to cut billions in Medicare fraud ignites lobbying frenzy. And that is specifically about cutting payments to Medicare Advantage plans because they seem to be defrauding the government, overbilling the Medicare system in so many instances. But let me ask you a couple of pushback questions. One is simply, healthcare cost inflation is real, and something has to be done to control healthcare costs. Managed care plans like Medicare Advantage plans are, you know, a central way that governments, unions, private sector companies are trying to do that. How else can you save the city $600 million a year, the number that they cite, and do whatever your part is to cut back on healthcare costs?
So I'm going to tell you, for a Medicare eligible retiree, the cost of us is less than 0.6% of the entire city budget. The retirees gave. We gave in blood, sweat, tears, and didn't take raises. So I think coming to a retired person who doesn't have a seat at a bargaining table, you're basically selling me off to fund something. And again, I told you why we're in this situation. But to save money, how is this suddenly a crisis today when I'll fully agree with you that there's issues, you know, that healthcare is expensive. But healthcare is, every mayor, since I've been reading in the archives going back to the 60s, says healthcare is expensive. That's not anything new. And that the city is all of a sudden saying it's a crisis now. Where have they been for the last 10, 15 years in trying to push back on savings, trying to find savings or cut back in any other way? Why haven't they pushed the insurers to negotiate better with the hospitals so that they aren't getting fleeced, as the MLC says? But then you're going to force me into privatized Medicare Advantage, allowing a for-profit insurer to take over our health care just because it's being funded by the federal government. I don't quite understand that. We don't typically give out handouts, but then we're asking the federal government for a handout to take care of our health care that the city mismanaged. Did I get that
another
right?
Another pushback.
I'm not quite understanding that.
Well, is Medicare Advantage really that bad? The stats I see are that a large share of Medicare recipients, approaching half, choose Medicare Advantage plans voluntarily, when you look at the stats nationwide, because of the extra benefits that traditional Medicare doesn't cover, like vision and dental and hearing aids. So lots of folks voluntarily make that trade-off to have their choice of doctors limited in those plans, yes, and have the plan screen their tests and treatment options for medical necessity, yes. But with so many Americans choosing that trade-off, is it so bad to be on Medicare Advantage?
I'm going to say that they're not all choosing. Most of their employers are auto-enrolling them, forcing them off their employer health care right now.
Both things are happening.
Because of a federal rule. Yes, so you do have some voluntarily going into them because of the perks that they're being sold. Heck, I met a woman in Florida who said that her Medicare Advantage plan gives her a debit card of $75 a month so she can go buy groceries. I don't think we should be trading off health care, access to medical providers, in order to get a $75 debit card. When I need a doctor, I need a doctor. To be able to tell me that there's, in Medicare, 97% of doctors in America take Medicare. The last Medicare Advantage plan, the Alliance, only 75% of the doctors in America would accept that plan. That's a narrowed network. And then that, knowing that doctors can drop out of Medicare Advantage, the prior authorizations, when I'm sick and I'm getting older, I can't handle doing administrative work, having to wait for denial appeals and denials of care. The Office of Inspector General found that Medicare Advantage companies are for-profit, and the way that they make money is by denying and delaying your care. This is the statistic that's real. If healthcare is being denied by people, and knowing that a small percentage of them do appeal and a majority of those appeals get overturned, what does that tell you? That this is a for-profit making scheme, that the easiest way to do this is to delay and deny you care, hoping you don't appeal, especially when the OIG finds that the majority of the people that did appeal, that they were wrongly denied or delayed their care. And their appeal, their denials got overturned. Why would you put a senior citizen through that?
Let me read some tweets that are coming in on the city and the union side. Somebody writes, why is everyone so upset? Comparison chart, similar to benefits of the GHI senior care. That's GHI, the plan that I guess the UFT members like, except maybe they made such a stink that Emblem backed out, and now they will have Aetna, which is a relative unknown to the retirees. I've been with HIP/Emblem Medicare Advantage for years. It's fine, says one listener. Another listener on the other side of that says, my parents worked for the city for decades, now in their 90s in the Bronx in their apartment. That Aetna plan is not accepted by any of their current doctors at a well-run clinic. The mayor and Michael Melgrew are abandoning our elderly retired public service workers. And so to that point that listener tweets and that you raised a minute ago about what doctors are in the plan, here's another clip of Michael Melgrew from his WNYC interview on March 10th saying this plan will serve retirees because he knows what retirees care about and they negotiated in some relevant safeguards. Listen.
Right now, if you're a city retiree, the main questions our retirees are always concerned with is, may I see my doctor? We're going from 185,000 doctors in a plan to 1.2 million. And we have performance guarantees with financial penalties on it if the company doesn't get everyone to either be in the plan or accept the billing. The next piece is we wanted to grow our network because we have retirees all over the country and we were able to grow the network immensely. So I think that will be better for them. And the big difference here is on a monthly basis, all of this information and data goes to a committee of which we're part of. And we can go to an arbitrator quickly for what's known as an expedited arbitration if we feel that someone's being denied something wrongly.
March 10th, Michael Melgrew on the station. So what's your response to that? And specifically what he points out there, that a very large number of doctors will be included, that's being negotiated in, and a cap on how many denials of claims or service there can be without mandatory fines or arbitration built in if they don't meet the targets.
Okay. First of all, we don't have to go through that procedure, any of those procedures in traditional Medicare. That he initially even has to set up something like that is a travesty that tells you he knows there's problems coming. So let's try to mitigate that by putting all these different panels and things in place in order to capture it, look at it, see if it was real. No. My doctor should be telling me what I need, not an insurance company, the MLC, Michael Melgrew. And this is where we got to get away from this. The network. The network is narrowed because Aetna's talking point is 88% of the doctors retirees currently see are in the Aetna network. Well, if there's 183,000 Medicare eligible retirees, 88% of them are currently in the Aetna network. How about how many doctors are in America that accept Aetna Medicare Advantage? That's what I would like to know, because no one's answering that question. Because if Aetna could have said it, Aetna would have said 88% of doctors in America will accept Aetna Medicare Advantage, not saying only 88% of doctors retirees currently see. And that's an issue, because I may see 10 doctors today, but as I get older or sicker, hey, look, I'm a 9/11 responder. We have 9/11 people. We have people that are affected by 9/11 with cancers that aren't responders. And those people need their health care because that's their first line of defense. The city lied to us by saying the air is safe. Go back to work. The mayor won't release documents because he's saying that it would hold the city liable. There would be a negligence claim against the city if he released those documents. That tells you he knows we're getting sick and dying because of our exposure. Those people who are not responders, they rely on their health care, knowing that major cancer centers around America don't take a Medicare Advantage plan. What do you tell those people, and is the city going to lie to them again?
Let me get one more retiree voice on the phones here, and then I'm going to ask you a closing question about where you go from here. I know this is not only in negotiations, it's also in court. But John in Rockville Center, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thank you for taking the call. I'm a former president of the Captains and Down Association, New York City Police Department. Just to really hone in on what Marianne said, this happened because of what we call pattern bargaining in New York City. So once one union goes in and sets the pattern, all the other unions have to accept that. Right, it's a great gimmick that the city has. So all they have to do is pick off a union, and then boom, that's the pattern for everybody else. Well, this time, what happened is, as she said, DC 37 and the UFT combined control the MLC. They vote, boom, it's done. So what they did, De Blasio, offer the sweetener, give me $400 million in savings from the MLC. This is the contract you have, DC 37. They were happy. They got it. None of the other active unions got it for their active members, just those two unions, and they sold everybody else down the river, and they sold the retirees down with them. And that's the actual fact, and that's the problem that we have.
John, thank you very much. So what happens next? I know this is in court. I also know this is happening all across the country. Many private companies that promise health insurance to retirees are forcing them onto Medicare Advantage plans to save money in exactly the same way. We've talked about that during this conversation. So, A, is there a national coalition that includes your group forming, or could it form, to increase its clout? And what's the legal argument? Like, you may not like that this is being done, but I know you're in court on it. So how can you argue that it's illegal?
So we do have a legal coalition. I mean, sorry, a national coalition that we are building, because we have aligned with retirees in Vermont, Chicago, Washington, Delaware, and the states keep calling us going, how are you fighting this? What could we do? They're doing this to us. Rather than taking the easy road, municipalities know their obligation. The city of New York knew its obligation since 12-126 was legislated in 1967. Their failure to plan shouldn't be our emergency to handle today. My organization is run on the premise that we have several different things that we can do to protect retirees. We are trying to do legislation. The city council speaker the other day on your show didn't think that this was a council issue. This absolutely is a council issue, and we rely upon her and the legislative body to protect us, because that's what we have. The council blessed us with 12-126 in 1967. They gave that to us. And year after year, Mary Pinkett, who is the council person from District 28 and 35, the same seat that currently Crystal Hudson and Speaker Adams sits in today, championed retiree health care. And I keep saying I need my modern day Mary Pinkett, because she and Peter Vallone helped protect retirees through the decades. So I know legislation is the way. We have a bill that's been sitting in the city council legislative office that requires the city to provide us with a Medigap plan, a choice of a Medigap. And because the code is staying the same, that the city must pay for all employees, retirees, and their dependents up to the same amount of money, it would still be premium free. I would advocate for savings all day long with you, just not on the backs of retired labor who don't have a seat at the table or a seat in the room. And at this point, I paid my due. So I want to make sure that whether I go for litigation or legislation, that we have support, and the council needs to be there to help support us, because we told them why we're in this situation. We've called for an investigation on the misuse of the stabilization fund, and that's fallen on deaf ears. And that's not even a fund that pays for our health care. And if you look at the cost of a Medicare-eligible retiree, like I said before, our cost to the city is less than 0.6% of the entire budget. We don't cost what an active worker costs the city. So I'm tired of hearing the misinformation about, oh, it's $600 million. According to the CAFA report, the Medicare-eligible retirees' cost to the city was $439 million. Is that still a lot of money? Yes. But it's not when you take into consideration all the others. We won in court. We won twice. We won in the appellate court. Six justices, two courts affirmed that the law was broken by the unions and the city. And they've done nothing but try to go around the judge's decision, misinterpret what the judge said to try to only offer one plan. They tried to intimidate a legislative body to change the law that we won our case on. And then when they realized they weren't going to get their way, what did they do? They eliminated every health care plan that was available to a retiree for whatever reason, to force them only into one plan that benefits them, that leaves many of our retirees with higher prescription costs and no access to their medical doctors or their continuing care residential communities.
And the fight goes on. Mary Ann Pizzatola, president of a group that is formed around this issue, the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.